From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It is an irony that the drama of the campaign season, this one anyway, can drown out serious discussion of the large, urgent issues facing this country. But those are the problems we need to tackle. Citizens are thinking a lot about them, including some very well-informed citizens. One, Jim Stone, is with me today, and we want to hear from you. This hour On Point, from inequality to the banks to education, really taking on America's biggest problems at last, right here, right now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can we see past gridlock and deadlock to act in this country to make the country's future bright? And what's your prescription for addressing inequality, high health care costs, national debt, the banks? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Jim Stone, citizen, thinker, one-time public servant. Jim says the United States is at risk of becoming an aristocracy of wealth. He's founder and chief executive of the Plymouth Rock Group of Insurance Companies, former chairman of the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission, former insurance commissioner of Massachusetts, and he's author of the new book, Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Full disclosure, Jim Stone is a donor to this station, WBUR, and his company is an underwriter. His wife is on the board. But it's his ideas and the ideas they prompt in you that we're interested today in the midst of this 2016 campaign season. Jim Stone, welcome to On Point. Great to have you right here.
Happy to be here.
So, you have got a lot of really detailed and thought-through solutions here for really big problems. Tick them off for us. Which are your five that you're taking on? Not too shabby a list?
Yeah, the things I've called the five easy theses are fiscal balance, that is causing the budget to be no more out of balance than it ought to be.
Deficit, all that.
Yeah, the deficit, that's right, and Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
The second one would be inequality, which you mentioned a moment ago. It seems to be increasing very rapidly in this country, particularly wealth inequality. Then education. I think that our education system isn't particularly well-serving kids that are not going to go on to college, and it's becoming unaffordable for those who are.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare, where it's not that our healthcare is poor, it's that we spend about 7 points of GNP more than anybody else for it. It's over a trillion.
Mm-hmm.
Over a trillion a year more.
You could do a lot with that on other things.
Yeah, and we don't seem to have better results for spending that extra trillion. And then finally, Wall Street reform, financial sector reform.
We can see the importance of that. You warn in the book, you say the greatest threat to traditional American values today is the drift toward an aristocracy of wealth. What do you mean by that, and where do you see the drift?
Well, this has been a country that has been enormously successful by historical standards, with a very strong middle class, which I believe is the engine of its success. Recently, there's been an accelerating trend towards the income and the wealth flowing to the upper 1% or even the upper 1% of 1%.
Mm-hmm. And with that, an aristocracy of the wealth seems to suggest a kind of a calcification of that, a kind of a setting in of a new order.
Yeah, that's no way to have a meritocracy of an economy, and our economy has been based on meritocracy. We're a place where people who are really good at things can get to the top, invent things, create companies. If all the wealth is at the top, that's not going to happen as much anymore. And it influences politics, undermines democracy, takes away people's ambition. It's just not a good thing to have a country where bloodlines rather than merit get you to the top.
Is that aristocracy of wealth, as you put it, do you think, is it something to do with the fact that we're not solving these big problems you're laying on the table? If it's not that, what is it? Why aren't we taking these on? They're right there. They're right in front of us. You know, the scale of them and the impact of them seems pretty obvious, and yet we're not solving them year after year.
They're very hard to take on. Some of them are driven by changes in technology, some of them by the financialization, I call it, of the economy. The financial sector tends to move money towards the wealthiest. And some are the result of bad policy. But to fix them, you've got to change some things that are culturally deep in American thought. You've got to do the – you've got to change the taxation system and go where the wealth is.
There's so much we're going to look at and dive into here, but just step back for a second. When I look at this country, I see all these problems in front of us right now, but something in me, something deeper in me says, looks at what we have in this country and says, this should be a fabulous century for the United States. We've got this great diverse population bursting with many angles of seeing the world, all the resources, many of them that we've built up over so many now centuries of work here and blessed with all these still natural resources. Is there any reason, if we can get past these, not to be optimistic about this country's future, this century?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I'm not a pessimist. I think that that America does have a bright future, that all of these problems can be solved. We don't have to be pessimistic about the country, but we do have to solve the problems.
You say you're right up front. You're saying you're a Democrat, but you say you're putting politics aside here. And you ask the reader, you say, mm-hmm. to think logically and try to put aside political categories. Why? And how does one do that these days in such a, we always describe our politics as polarized.
Well, sometimes issues can be led, the public can be led by politicians, and sometimes politicians have to be led by the public. The issues that I've picked, I really think take a change, a public mind reset, a change in public thinking before you're going to get politicians to take what look like courageous or even foolhardy stands. Mm-hmm. And that takes some considerable thinking. Politicians naturally will drift towards things that have reasonably quick fixes and can be expressed in sound bites. Mm-hmm. This book is meant to aim the opposite way.
It goes deeper. Let's dive in. Let's take on the debt. Start with debt and deficit. It's been talked about a lot for a long time, and yet it grows. There it is. Social Security and the other entitlement commitments are part of that. Walk us into your thinking about it and how you would take it on to maybe clear that away and brighten the future, the American future.
Yeah. Well, on this subject of the national debt, I try to break it into two parts. There's a short-term part and a long-term. The short-term, the biggest problem is that we waste a tremendous amount of money that shows up in the deficit. And the major place we wasted in it is what economists call tax expenditures. They're tax deductions that people can take. It cuts government revenue. And often they don't produce much. They don't get studied the same way as appropriations do, where every year an appropriation gets debated.
So wait a minute. So when people talk about waste in the political arena, they're usually talking about fraud, waste, and abuse. They mean
right.
Sort of poor government function leading to waste. But you're saying something else. You're saying there are tax revenues out there that should be part of the Commonwealth that are not because they're exempted?
Well, I'll call it poor government function, but in a different way. Mm-hmm. It's poor function on the part of Congress to allow things that they're probably being convinced by some lobbyist or powerful interest to do to stay in the tax code. If we just got rid of some of these tax expenditures, which range from, there's oil depletion there used to be, I think it's now being finally phased out, a tobacco subsidy, mm-hmm. but there are other farm subsidies. And then the one that I aim most directly at is interest deductions.
So you're really talking tax breaks when you say tax expenditures, but it's a way of bleeding out resources that we would otherwise have.
I'm perfectly happy calling them tax breaks.
Interest deductions. And you're looking at both personal, including mortgage interest deductions, and corporate. The corporate side was an eye-opener for me, the way you lay it out. I'd never thought quite so clearly about how when companies borrow money, they get a tax break on the interest.
Yeah.
And so it's no wonder that we've had all these leveraged buyouts. It's almost a government subsidy of buying out other companies.
It's not almost. It is.
It is.
It is exactly
which
that.
Has turned all kinds of corners of the economy upside down.
That's right. You have companies having more debt than they would otherwise have because debt is subsidized, and you have much more concentration because you have all these buyouts and a small number of people controlling huge numbers of companies.
End those corporate interest tax breaks. What
yes.
about the private, the mortgage interest deduction? Many people treasure that in their family budget.
Yes. That's one of those ones that takes a public mindset. I wouldn't expect any politician to jump out in front of that one, as people think they're coming out ahead until they think about it carefully. Because when there's a tax break, it's going to be made up by taxes in some other area. So who gets the break? Well, only people who itemize deductions. That's the richest third. Mm-hmm. The break is proportional to how big your home is, up to $1 million. Mm-hmm. So it's a break that favors those with the biggest homes. Mm-hmm. And people who need help the most from the government tend to be renters. They get nothing here.
If we took the steps that you outline here, what would it mean for the national debt and deficit?
If you just removed the interest deductions alone, you'd about balance the budget.
Presto, right off the bat?
Pretty much, yeah.
That sounds great. What would the impact be for the country if we could do that?
Well, then you get a real debate that I would like to see. I personally am not particularly in favor of a balanced budget. I think we could spend the money on other things.
Meaning there are times when you borrow to do important things like fix up our infrastructure, whatever it might be.
Exactly. Great nations run deficits for things that are investments in the future.
A rule might apply to government borrowing, you say here. A country should never borrow to postpone political discomfort, which we're doing now, I guess, by your lights.
Yes.
Only when its next generation will be grateful that it did. But how nice it would be to have the option of doing that for things that we can see make a difference for our future, a positive difference.
Well, I guess you could have written this book because I totally agree with that.
No, I don't think so. Social Security is part of this. We've got to take a short break right here.
Sure.
We're going to come back and look at that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about how to really solve America's biggest problems with one savvy citizen who's stepping up with some big ideas, and we're inviting yours. We're not waiting for the politicians. We are pushing ahead right here. My guest is Jim Stone. He's author of the new book, Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. He was chairman of the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission back in Carter Reagan years. He was commissioner of insurance in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. He's a founder and CEO of Plymouth Rockets Group of Insurance Companies. But he's also a citizen thinking about the big problems facing all of us and sharing the same frustration a lot of us do, that we're not getting more traction, more action on solving them. You can join us this hour. What do you think of my guest Jim Stone's ideas? Are you ready to ditch the interest deduction to tackle the deficit? Ready to raise the eligibility age for Social Security? We'll look at that. Ready to go to a kind of single payer, not that simple, but something in that arena for health care? Ready for a universal national service program for the young, maybe as an answer to some of our education problems? How would you dive in on inequality, on the big banks, on health care, on the debt and deficit, and more? Jim Stone is with me in the studio. Take us to Social Security and your concern about these entitlements, their impact if we don't address them, what you think would be the best way to address them.
Yeah. Polls show that young people have very little faith that Social Security is going to be around to help them. And in fact, we do need to make changes. But they're not that difficult, but they're political nightmares, and politicians just hate to talk about changing Social Security. But
driving us over a cliff or into a wall doesn't sound like a great idea either, but it's a few years down the road.
Well, that's right. And we shouldn't wait until we're very close to that wall and at a high speed.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is people are living a lot longer and working a lot longer than they did when all these eligibility rules were set. They used the mortality tables from the time of Franklin Roosevelt. Those have changed.
To be 65 then was a pretty good run.
People now live close to 80. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a different world. And I think, because I'm very interested in science, it's going to be very much more different in the future.
You mean we may live longer and longer?
I suspect we'll live a lot longer, that there will be tremendous progress in the next 5 to 10 years in cancer, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what's your answer on Social Security?
Well, it's not that you do it because you want to, but we're going to have to move up the eligibility age. And that is a very powerful thing. We can move it up gradually, but that's going to need to be done. And the sooner we do it, the more gradual it can be and the less painful it can be. It's just a fact that people are living longer after retirement.
How much do you have to move it to move the needle on the debt or on the uncovered obligations?
Every year is very powerful. You don't have to move it more than 2 or 3 years.
Is that fair? You say we're going to live longer, but we see all these headlines saying, well, the wealthy are living longer. That's true, but the poor are not necessarily living longer. And lately, we've seen white middle-class Americans and white middle-class women, not to mention all the minorities who have suffered with this for a long time, but those ages going down.
Yeah. Actually, the progress is shared across wealth. The wealthy live longer, but both are living longer than they used to. And so there is progress in both. But in any case, you can't solve that unfairness through anything through the Social Security system.
If we've got this inequality and an aristocracy of wealth, why not, instead of raising the eligibility age to receive Social Security payments, why not raise the amount of income on which the well-off pay Social Security taxes?
Well, I'm not opposed to that. I think that should probably be done too. And raising that cap, unfortunately, doesn't solve the whole problem. And it's got some flaws. It takes away, to some extent, the last insurance element to the program, which is part of its popularity.
Meaning, oh, everybody pitches in, but everybody would still be pitching in.
Well, if it's all proportional to income, then it begins to look like a tax and not an insurance program, even more than it does now. It's a hybrid now. And so that's one reason not to, but also
– but it wouldn't be all income. What if we just put the cap instead of – what is it now, 110 or 15? I'm not even sure. Put it up to 210.
Yeah. As I said, I'm not opposed to raising the cap, but it doesn't solve the whole problem.
It's just not enough revenue from
that. And it doesn't really hit the right people, because the really wealthy aren't getting their money in income. Not in taxable income.
Yep.
They're getting it in capital gains, mostly unrealized. So they get richer and richer. They don't pay this tax. So you're really hitting the upper middle class when you do that. Again, we can do that, but it's not going to solve the whole problem, especially if people start living into their 90s.
Calls for you. Louisville, Ohio. Philip is on the air. Philip, thank you very much for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I'm listening with great delight to Mr. Stone's talk on this whole problem in this country. Me, I'm more of a historian, and I trace the whole thing going back from where people need to learn from the Roman Empire, where you had eventually the small landowners who were duty-bound to serve in the military when the need arose, and then basically the landowners took over everything. These people were reduced to poverty. They had to move to the city. And basically, that's why the Roman Empire fell, because you basically had a concentration of the rich and powerful, and you basically took the rights away from the people.
Philip, does that sound, I mean, are you that worried about our republic at this point, that that's a metaphor or an example that really seems relevant here?
Sure. And take a look at the French right now. When the French aristocrats had their army, the army they had was conscripted, and what happened was when the French Revolution came around, the army had no loyalty to the aristocrats because they were drawn from the people. When the Revolution came around, they had mercenaries they could count on, but there weren't that enough of them. And so when they ordered the troops to fire upon the people to prevent the revolution, they looked there, they saw their brothers, their sisters, their relatives, people from the dregs that they had came from. And suddenly it was like, no, I'm not going to fire upon these people. They are my brothers and sisters. And it stopped right there, and the aristocrats were overthrown.
Philip, let us hold it right there, and let us hope we never have to go there. But Jim Stone, you write about inequality, and that's really the heart of what Philip's talking about there. There are lots of impacts of it that you describe in the book. But go to inequality. Let's just take it on. In practical terms, common sense terms, you say in the book, how would you take it on?
The only way you can get it, inequality, because most of it is in wealth and not income. We always think about income, but wealth
who
is
makes
much
what,
more
but it's
important.
Who's accumulated and what, and the interest on that.
Yeah, wealth is much more important in determining power in society, ability to influence politics, all of the things you'd be concerned about. Mm-hmm. And in order to take on wealth, you really have to take look at the tax code and say, are we hitting the right things? And most of the gain of the very rich comes in what are called unrealized gains. You don't sell the stock. You hold the stock.
And it's just growing and growing. There's no tax bite at all. It's just but the wealth is growing all that time.
Yeah. I've been a beneficiary of that. I run a company. Mm-hmm. My stock keeps going up in value. Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay taxes on that. And so we really have to think about taxing those unrealized gains. It's a big cultural change.
That would be as big as when the income tax was brought in, right? I mean, those have always been sacrosanct, off limits.
Yes, and I don't think it was a mistake for the United States to do that, as difficult as it was.
The income tax, you mean?
Yes, the income tax.
So now if we did this, how big a pot is that? What would the impact be?
Oh, it's an enormous pot, and you could tax at a very, very low rate. But let me also add that the other tax that I favor is the one that's least popular today, and that is the estate tax, you know, what some people don't like, I'd like to call the death tax.
Or the inheritance tax.
Inheritance tax. Mm-hmm. That's the fairest of all taxes.
The fairest. Now, defenders say, my family, you know, built this wealth, and why shouldn't I be able to give it to my kids?
And therefore, we have some exemption, and you can leave some money to your kids. But if you look at what people who are extraordinarily wealthy are able to pass on through devices of trusts and overseas accounts, you're talking about being able to pass on billions if you want to. And that makes no sense.
What's the impact of that over time?
Well, that's what can cause this aristocracy of wealth. That's exactly what a democracy shouldn't want, either for political reasons or economic reasons. Tends to stultify the economy. Look at the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. If the king and the dukes had everything, everybody had nothing, you have 1,000 years, the economy doesn't grow. We don't like
no,
that.
No thanks to that.
I don't like that prospect.
We don't like it. We don't like it.
That's worse than the Roman Empire.
Yes, indeed. Craig in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Craig, you're on with Jim Stone.
Hi, I was wondering if it was feasible or what kind of tools it would take if the Fed was given a mandate to try and control financial inequality in the U.S.
The Fed a role there. What do you think, Jim? Can you see it? They've got a role for employment, in encouraging employment, not in also discouraging inflation. What about adding one more?
Yeah, the Fed does have one huge role in all of this, which is it's the principal overseer of the financial sector. And the financial sector has been a big contributor to this movement towards inequality of wealth and income. So the Fed has a role, but I don't see it having a role other than as the supervisor of the financial sector. I think it's more Congress that's going to have to deal with this.
If you start going after estates in a much more aggressive way, you start going after unrealized gains, that is, wealth that's just sitting there, you're not cashing out, but you're paying taxes. Are people going to say, hey, this is Bernie Sanders stuff. Here is the political revolution. Jim Stone's leading it. Does it have that kind of tang in Washington? And can you imagine the big guns that would come out in response?
Well, either you're going to do something about wealth concentration or you're not. And if you want to do something about it, you got
to
look where
not
the wealth
to decide
is.
Not decide is to decide, as we used to say.
That's right. We have a policy, and it's a bad one, which is that we allow people to set up all these trusts. We allow them to accumulate and accumulate. We allow them to essentially defer the taxes forever. That's bad policy.
We're talking about taking on really big problems with Jim Stone. His new book is Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. Let's go to that financial sector, Jim. I mean, you were there in the Commodity Futures Trading Commission back in the day when derivatives began to peek out and show themselves. Now here we are. We've been through the Great Recession. We saw how things could just come tumbling down very nearly catastrophically. There's a lot of money concentrated there. It's changed the face of our economy, where the weight of our economy is. What would you do about it? Are you a Sanders guy? Break up the banks? Are you a Trump guy? I'm not even sure what his position there. Or a Cruz guy or a Clinton guy?
Well, there has been a lot of talk in this campaign about large banks, and I welcome that talk. I would like to see the banks downsized. I don't know that breaking up is the right way to describe it.
What's the difference between downsize and breaking up?
Well, breaking up sort of implies you take a bank and you take a knife and you cut it into five parts.
But downsizing, there's got to be a knife somewhere or something.
Well, downsizing can mean requiring them to put up a lot more reserves. You can make it so that their economics drives them, paying extra because they cause risk in the economy when they get over a certain size.
You mean, so they can't lend as much against their reserve cash that they have on hand, so we can't get so far out over the roadrunner cliff there.
Well, if they were lending, I'd feel a little better about them. But unfortunately, their biggest business now is probably derivatives, and that's not in the national interest. That's what should be discouraged. Just to give you a quick statistic,
yes,
I think the total derivative, open derivative positions of the 10 largest banks are now over $200 trillion, which is three times the world's GNP.
And we want,
that is not
that's
economics.
Mind-blowing.
It is not commercial activity.
Well, put this in very straightforward terms, because we want to get it out there just so clearly that citizens feel empowered to act on this, to talk about it. And not everybody's going to understand. Even for me, it gets fuzzy sometimes when you get out into derivatives and everything else.
Yeah.
What are we really talking about here, and what would your solutions do to rein it in?
Yeah. So derivatives are instruments in which you can take a position in something without actually owning or being about to own or selling the actual thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's derivative to some actual thing that's
like
moving
what?
In price. So you could have wheat futures, silver futures, futures on interest rates.
It's a bet.
Things that are betting on a statistic that's moving up and down and don't necessarily involve the thing itself.
So it's kind of artificial economy.
Yes, and they serve a useful function. It's not that they're not useful.
Mm-hmm.
It's that they're useful to the point of a hill, and instead we have Mount Everest.
Okay. So to tamp that down again, you would?
Yeah. Every time a bank opens a position in one of these derivatives, it ought to have to put up a reserve. The accounting system doesn't require that. The regulators don't require that. But that's why if the banks get in trouble again, despite all the sincere attempt of Dodd-Frank to make sure that bailouts wouldn't happen, you can't be sure that it wouldn't happen again because you have these trillions of dollars of positions that no one can understand, just too big.
Why is this important? Beyond the risk of collapse, which is a pretty big deal in itself, but you write that this unlimited leverage contributes to the financial sector's enrichment, the financial sector's enrichment at the rest of the economy's expense. What does that mean?
Yeah. The reason banks are so big into derivatives is that they make a lot of money in derivatives. But where can that money be coming from? Well, there's only one place where there's enough money to pay for all of those derivatives, and that is the rest of the economy. I think a very, very perspicacious quote from 1925 is from Winston Churchill, who said, I would rather see the financial sector less proud and industry more content.
Do you think that – I mean, we talk about trade and all these other things, but is the very growth of Wall Street and the banks part of what has put headwinds in the face of Main Street and American industry?
Absolutely. That is what I'm saying.
But it's often touted by politicians – well, not now, but as a sign of American strength and the sort of vigor of the American market economy.
The whole sector that includes banks, and we haven't yet talked about hedge funds, but they're important too. That whole sector is meant to serve the commercial economy, not to take the whole front row and dominate it. At one time, it had a single-digit percentage of all of America's profits. That got up in the 2000s to roughly a third of all of America's profits. That's just too much.
So we've got debt and deficit that we've got answers to here. We've got the concentration of wealth and inequality here on the banks. If you could solve this, we'll come back to hedge funds, but if you could solve this, the impact, apart from risk reduction, a healthier American economy overall and for more people?
Absolutely. A fairer economy and a healthier economy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about how to really solve America's biggest problems with one savvy citizen who is stepping up with some big ideas, and we're inviting yours. We're not waiting for the politicians here. We're pushing ahead right now. My guest is Jim Stone. His new book is 5 Easy Theses, Common Sense Solution to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. He says, all right, let's try and set politics aside and look at this in a, just a common sense way. Can we break through and do something about these things? If we don't, we're headed for an aristocracy of wealth and worse, in economic terms, maybe. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Do we really need to be so gridlocked, deadlocked over these issues? Is there a way to push the politicians and get these things done? Can you see a dazzling future out there if we just get this accomplished? And is there really any good reason why we can't, to use a phrase, make America great again? Lots of response online here. ARC says, we've transformed our economy, Jim, from a bottom-up style of economics to a top-down style of economics. This is foolish and ruinous. Government had a role in guiding this at one point, but it's become so bogged down in corporate money that it's become useless at it. If we don't take care of the problem, we're headed toward a capitalism-based feudal system. Well, okay. Patrick says, having worked on the Hill, there's no shortage of good ideas to benefit the public interest. Behind every congressperson, a team of smart people pitching solid ideas, which, of course, never see the light of day because the public interest takes a backseat to special interest more often than not. Want a simple fix? Do something about the lobbyists and the money that pours in from special interests.
I love your callers today.
Yes, good, good. What do you think about this one? I mean, do these things have a chance if these interests that have now accumulated a lot of dough are lined up unimpeded in D.C.?
They don't have much chance in the short run, and that's why I say sometimes the politicians will lead and sometimes the public has to lead. Mm-hmm. In this kind of thing, the public has to lead because the money – contributions are going to be on the other side. I think we left off talking. We're going to talk about hedge funds a little bit.
Well, I've got a question
big
on that front, if I may. Let me just go there.
Sure.
Gail is on that, I think, in Fish Creek, Wisconsin.
Sure.
Gail, you're on with Jim Stone.
Hi, thank you. Great show, great guest. My question, I have a kind of comment and a question, is with the debates going on and for the presidential election, is what we're talking about is the derivative things. Is that more like the shadow banking that Hillary Clinton is talking about getting rid of and Donald Trump is also talking about in the way business has been done? Some of it has been he's just saying totally wrong. I mean, I know he has a plan, but that this is what's been putting us into the financial problems because it's been artificially inflating and only inflating realistically, tangibly for a small group of people who are the in crowd. And this is what they're going to want to be getting rid of because that's what started to ruin the economy and that's what we've been tanking.
Gail, I'm really glad you raised it. Shadow banking, when you hear that, are you thinking hedge funds? Describe what comes to mind when you hear it, Jim.
Yeah. Shadow banking, institutions that gather and move tremendous amounts of money without the regulation that banking has. So it is pretty much what the caller was talking mm-hmm. about. And it has come up in the campaign. And there are suggestions made, but they don't go anywhere near far enough. Again, this is where the public is going to have to push.
So tell us about the scale of this and the impact of this.
The scale is in the trillions. And basically what happened is that after the 1929 crash, the Franklin Roosevelt administration put in the right kinds of safeguards, and they really are two things. There's two concepts. That's all you got to know. One, you limit leverage. That is, you don't say I can bet a dollar, but I'm going to make it act like $4 by adding a lot of debt to it. And two, you have transparency. You tell the public what you're doing, what your transactions are. Mm-hmm. And that worked for 50 years. We had a great financial system for 50 years, the strongest, safest in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And then with tiny cracks, it began to be undermined. And now with this shadow banking system and what the caller was talking mm-hmm. about, we've got a system that's totally out of control that has nearly unlimited leverage and virtually no transparency.
And a risk equal to what we saw back in 2007-8?
Yes, I think so, because if there were a crisis, and that's what it depends on. There's always a new crisis. The last mm-hmm. crisis began with real estate, mm-hmm. but who knows where the next one will begin. Mm-hmm. What we have is a tremendous ship that isn't seaworthy, and we don't know where the storm's going to come from, mm-hmm. but when the storm comes, that non-seaworthy ship is going to sink. And then you're going to need bailouts again. You're going to need to do all of these extreme things you hate doing.
It's intolerable, and yet it's not being fixed. How would you fix it on this front, the hedge fund, shadow banking front?
I think that's logically easy, politically extremely difficult.
That's infuriating, but let's hear it. We'll get some folks to get behind it.
Hedge funds tend to be very generous contributors to campaigns.
So Bernie Sanders has reminded us.
But the answer is as simple as what the Roosevelt administration people told us. You got to limit their leverage and you got to make them disclose all their transactions.
It's not a fiery rallying cry, but if we could get it done, it could be a very, very big deal for this country, for risk, and for the rest of the economy. Steve in Portland, Oregon, coast to coast. Steve, you're on with Jim Stone.
Hi. I'm here with my group of eighth graders here. I'm a teacher. And
great.
Something I'm kind of wondering about is the effects that cognitive bias has on this situation. I've talked to my students a lot about the idea of cognitive bias, things like the Dunning-Kruger effect, about hyperbolic discounting, and how our education doesn't seem to be preparing the public for fighting those cognitive biases and trying to, they vote for their immediate interest or they think that they're professionals when they think that they're professionals in a field outside their area of professional thinking. So they might think they know about climate change even though they're not a climate scientist, and they go against the general views of climate science. Does that make sense?
So you think as in maybe a political ideology might close people's ears to practical solutions, that sort of thing?
That sort of thing. But in general, people losing faith in professionals because they think just because they read a couple blog articles, they think that they know all of the contingencies having to do with climate science, and that lends them to cognitive biases that will eventually lead them to things like conspiracy theories or everyone's trying to fool me, be sheeple, that kind of thing.
Right, or really just taking on the problem. You throw a lot of hyperbole around and it certainly can be confusing. We see plenty of that. There can be interests behind that. And maybe that's hyperbolic discounting, Jim. But Steve, I'm so glad you're listening there in Portland, Oregon with your eighth graders. How do you explain why straightforward solutions run into so much headwind and discounting, maybe on that as a matter of political ideology, maybe something else?
Well, the caller raises an interesting question, but I'm not sure I come down on the same side of it, because on scientific matters, yes, I want to listen to the scientists. Mm-hmm. But on economic matters, for example, on banking, I don't know that I want to listen to the bankers. And so part of what causes a public mindset is you see where the leaders are going, and that's influenced by money. And then you see where the experts are going, and that's influenced by money. So there have got to be countervailing forces. There has to be reason brought to bear as well.
Mm-hmm. But you've got to have a populace that's willing to hear that, willing to take that on board. Our teacher with his eighth grade class wonders about how we're educating people. Let me hold that thought one more right here. Alex in Binghamton, New York. You're on the air with Jim Stone. Alex.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great show. Listening to your guest, Mr. Stone, I'm struck by similarities with many of his points that he has in his book with what Bernie Sanders has been proposing through most of his campaign this year. And what has amounted to lip service by almost every candidate throughout my lifetime, many decades, Sanders has moved this dialogue to the front of the line. And he's even moved his counterpart, Hillary Clinton, to left of center on this. I find that he's not getting that much traction based on his results in the primaries.
Alex, let me pick it up right there, if I may, with Jim Stone. And just put, we've got a lot of callers waiting here and more to get to. But Jim, are you a Bernie Sanders twin? Are you a Democratic Socialist? Are you left of center with these proposals?
Well, I'm not a socialist. I'm a big fan of Adam Smith, but I will say
that is the power of the free market for good.
Yeah, I think that it has to be a carefully regulated free market, and regulation may be a bad word to some people, but not to me and not to Adam Smith.
And not to this country for most of the 20th century.
That's correct. That's when everything has
worked
best, when it's been reasonably well regulated.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism can have excesses. It's still the best system around.
Bernie Sanders?
So I've purposely tried to stay away from the 2016 campaign because, unfortunately, you get quickly into the personalities of these candidates if you start discussing their issues.
And he's more than a personality. He's a platform.
And people like or don't like what you have to say based on whether they like or don't like the candidate you're talking about. I really want people to focus on these issues.
But do your policies look like his? That's what our caller's hearing, and I'm not sure that's the case.
Yeah, I think in a few cases they probably do, but in a few cases they look like other people's views. My views on Social Security, for example, are not the same as Sanders. My views on banking may look more like his, but I could take each of the candidates and say there are areas where my views intersect theirs and others where they're different.
Let's just listen for Common Sense Solutions. Here says my guest, Jim Stone. We've got dwindling time and two more big things to get to. Let's go to health care quickly. Now, there's the Affordable Care Act out there, Obamacare. That is a step of some kind. I don't know what you think of it, but you're still looking at how much we spend, $1 trillion a year, and we have poorer outcomes than other developed countries. What would you do about health care, Jim?
Yeah, the $1 trillion a year isn't what we spend. It's the excess over what we would spend.
Right. What we could save if we got it in order.
Exactly, if we spent the same percentage GNP as everybody else. It's basically basically waste, because we're not getting a better result for that extra trillion, and it's actually more than a trillion.
We're down to 4.5 minutes. Give us the fix, sir.
So this one is tough because, yes, I think there is a sort of single important fix, which is that every sophisticated country that manages to keep healthcare costs to about 10% of GNP instead of our 17 has some kind of single cost overseer. They're all different. And so you can't say we want this system or that system. France is perfect or Canada is perfect or England's perfect. They all have advantages and flaws, but they all have some kind of cost overseer.
Would our health care be as good as it is now if we had that?
There's every reason to think that it would. We have a pretty good system, but when you look at the mortality statistics, the obesity statistics, morbidity statistics, every kind of statistic you look at, we're not better than countries that spend 10% of GNP on health care.
Even though we spend $1 trillion beyond that. So what would you do in a nutshell, because we're getting down to nutshell time?
Yeah. Well, we have to take on some hard issues. We do have to take on the excess of testing, which has something to do with defensive medicine.
Diagnostic testing, drawing blood and all the rest
testing,
all the time.
Yes. We would have to take on marketing administration. We pay more for sales of health insurance policies than anybody else in the world by a tremendous amount. We seem to be pushing up pharmaceutical prices as a matter of public policy rather than down. That's really perverse. And lastly, our end-of-life care is unaffordable now, and it's going to be more unaffordable later.
Do you have to knock the private health insurance companies out of the box to do all this? Do you have to make it a single-payer federal government-run system?
Well, as I said, there are plenty of variants among countries that can get to the 10%. Some of them have a role for private insurers. Some don't. You can do it any number of ways, but you can't do it the way we're doing now. It just isn't addressing any of these tough issues.
We've got one more big one, education. It's so big I can't believe we've got a short time. But it's so heartening to hear solutions that we want to hear it anyway. We've got problems in grade school, problems with university cost. What would you do?
Yeah, the long ball approach here, which I favor, is to have universal service after high school.
What would that do for grade school education or for college costs?
I think it would help both. And let me see if I can explain.
Are you talking about young people being required to do a year or two of service?
Yes, I am.
And that would accomplish?
So the two problems that I highlight, and they're huge problems. One is that people who don't go to college, and that's the majority of the population, will not graduate from college. They're going on to career. They need career training. and we're not giving it to them in high school.
Universal service could be a venue for that.
It would be.
Okay.
And those who are going on to college, they can't afford it the way it's set up now, but we could give them affordable college credits in exchange for their work, and then everybody should be able to afford it.
So help build a dam or program something, or I don't know what that work would be, the universal service.
Infrastructure, military, social services, they all need it.
And do those things, and in return, come out of college without that giant debt.
That's correct.
Net-net, if we could implement your program tomorrow, how much better off would this country be tomorrow or in 10, 15, 30 years?
I don't know how to measure that, but if we don't change direction and we head towards all of these things going the wrong way, the lives of our children and grandchildren are going to be a lot worse. We can make them a lot better.
Citizen Jim Stone, you know, it's really heartening just to sit down and talk about real solutions. There's something that just makes the world feel firmer and brighter when we do it. We're grateful to you for really digging in as a private citizen and doing this. The book is Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jim Stone, thank you very much for being with us today.
Very happy to have been here. Thanks.
Just terrific to have you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.